The Catholics of Oz is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to episode 15 of The Catholics of Oz. The Catholics of Oz is a show where we discuss faith, culture, and what's been happening from an Aussie perspective. Whether it's synods or science, apostolates and apps, providence or productivity, you can hear it right now on The Catholics of Oz. Welcome to episode 15. It's good to be back. We had a bit of a break last weekend. I won't go into all the reasons why. There's a bit of a litany of those. But my name is Lindsay Sant, and it's good to have you all with us. And joining me today is Jared Trapnell. Jared, how are you today?
G'day, Linz.
It's good to have you with us. Unfortunately, we haven't got Caroline. So Caroline had to go to New Zealand for a funeral. And she's just returned yesterday and she's a bit jet lagged. So no Caroline today, but we'll have her hopefully back with us next episode. So before we begin, we'd just like to remind everyone that you can like the Catholics of Oz on the SQPN Facebook page. You can retweet our episodes on Twitter. Leave us comments, subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app. And also remember that we're on YouTube as well, so all you need to do is hit the bell on YouTube to get notifications when we have new episodes. Please also remember to leave us feedback on iTunes and other podcast directories and share our podcast with your friends to help us grow our community and to reach more listeners. So we're going to start today's episode. Normally we start with Faith Beyond Borders, but we're going to do it a bit differently today. We're going to start with something personal.
I bet you don't know anything about me.
You were born in Phoenix. You went to school in Tempe. You're an only child. Your favorite show is something called The Real Housewives of Atlanta. And your favorite book is Kendall Jenner's Instagram feed.
How did you know all that?
So, Jared, today's something personal is about a positive experience that we had last weekend. And that was the visit of Archbishop Peter Comensoli to our parish at Holy Family in Dufton. And it was a pastoral visit, so it wasn't a visit to do confirmations or other official business. It was a it was the bishop's initiative to have this, and it was a great visit. I think it was a positive occasion overall. And one of the main things that he did, apart from saying our 11 o'clock mass, was to offer an apology for the history of some of the sexual abuses that priests who had been assigned to Holy Family in the past. So I just thought, from the something personal perspective, I'll tell a bit of the story of just my experience of some of our parish in the past, and then finding out about some of these revelations, and then what it really meant for Archbishop Comensoli to come to our parish. So I'd probably go back to 2000 and maybe 11, 12, 13, around that time. And the ABC program, Four Corners, which is like a investigative journalism program, they go, you know, they investigate everything, they look around trying to find as many angles to a story as they can and as much detail as they can. They did a story on the sexual abuse of children in Victoria, in the Victorian churches, so in our four dioceses. And when I was watching it, clearly I was watching it to find out how extensive this issue was. And what shocked me and genuinely shocked me at the time was that our home parish of Holy Family in Dufton ended up being featured for about 5 minutes of the program. And what we found out, and this was later mentioned in subsequent news reports in The Age and other articles, people can Google this, it's all online still, was that there were at least three or four priests, abusive priests, who had been assigned to Holy Family one after the other. And their suggestion, although I can't really confirm this, but their suggestion that they were dumped there because it was known that they were abusers and they had been moved from one place after complaints about them to Holy Family because Holy Family was a relatively young parish. It was in a lower socioeconomic suburb. It was also a lot of migrants were coming through as well. So maybe it was, you know, considered a place to put some of these priests. Obviously not a good move because of, you know, some of the abuse that occurred afterwards. So I can remember clearly watching it and then calling Caroline on the phone straight away, who had been watching it as well. And we were speechless. We talked about the hurt that we felt because one of these priests, and I'm not really going to name any of these priests, but one of these priests was actually our parish priest when we were children. He was the parish priest through all of our primary school years because we went to the primary school at our parish. And he was a person who we'd had in our family home for dinner a lot, or we'd gone to his house. He'd taken altar boys on, you know, picnics and barbecues, you know, things like that, you know, social events and things like that. You know, to which I went to many of them. I can even remember him offering me advice at times, spiritual advice and spiritual guidance and things like that. So you can imagine how dismayed, I guess. I know that this story I'm telling is the story of a lot of other people who, you know, who had priests that they found out about later on. You know, people have reported to me, for example, priests that married them or, you know, did sacraments for their children and things like that, and how betrayed and hurt they felt. So the day after this news report on Four Corners, I went to work, and I didn't last 2 hours at work. I actually went to our daily organizer and said, look, I need to go home. Our pastoral associate at the time, she knew why I needed to go home. And so they basically let me go, no questions asked. So I went to Caroline's house straight away, and we had a big chat, a very, very big chat that afternoon. And so that was kind of how the story started, you know, this shock and then dealing with it. And the shock and the sadness that we have is nothing compared to the experience of the survivors who carry and are carrying this hurt for their whole life. But, you know, they're obviously, and we were talking about this before we started recording, you know, imagine priests who, you know, who are priests now and finding out that their colleagues, for example, or that their ministry has been tarnished by you know, sexual abuse of their colleagues, and that people may never look at the priesthood the same. You know, there are things that people say to priests. As an anecdote, Father Rob Gallia, who we interviewed a while back, he mentioned in some of his videos online, in some of his testimony as well, about how he's had people spit at him because he's a priest, and people swear at him and yell at him because of things that he didn't do, but because other priests have done them. And he's talked about that as well. So there are lots of people who are affected by the betrayal of these priests, and also by the cover-ups that happened subsequently as well. So getting to going a bit forward, we did have some good moments where the church tried to do a couple of things about it, but I always felt, and this isn't a criticism, but I always felt that the church's responses, the things they were trying to do, were a little late and a little insufficient. It took a long time for the church to, I'm talking about the Victorian church and some of the other the dioceses around here, to admit what had happened, to come up with an adequate response. And in a sense, they might have extended the hurt of some of the survivors as well. It was the Victorian Commission which first started and basically interviewed priests, interviewed you know, bishops and so on, and started getting the truth to come out, all the details that the church didn't reveal until this commission started, which was then followed by a royal commission, which is the highest level of investigation in this country, in which you can subpoena any witnesses, you can get any evidence. There's no, you can't withhold anything from a royal commission, which then opened up more about what happened Australia-wide this time, not just into the church, but all other institutions as well. So the scouts, there were tennis clubs and sport clubs also, and all kinds of other institutions that had children that had abused children too. But obviously the Catholic Church owning 1/3 of everything that happened is, you know, is quite a big stat. So they feature quite prominently. So it reached a bit of a turnaround for me. I went to the Australian Catholic Youth Festival in 2013 in Adelaide. And what happened was, this is all very serendipitous, I think. I, you know, had my youth group there, who I'd been taking along, you know, from our parish. And one of the people from the the Melbourne Catholic Youth Office came up to our group and said, oh, we're having a reception with the bishops. You know, the bishops want to speak to some young people from parishes and you know, and just meet a couple of leaders. So they invited me and just to go with another one of our youth group members to meet the bishops. So went up, you know, it was about an hour where bishops were saying a couple of things and, you know, walking around the room and meeting everyone like they do. And it was Bishop Mark Edwards who, you know, he was just asking who I was and where I was from. And he said, oh, so what parish? And I said, oh, from Holy Family in Dufton. And straight away, you know, his radar went off. He's like, oh, he goes, oh, you know, I'm sorry about the history of your parish and everything. I said, oh, you know, thank you. And he said, look, I'm speaking to everyone tomorrow. Do you mind if I ask your youth group to, you know, to stand up? Where you're sitting. I said, absolutely. So the day after, before introducing the next session, he was invited to come on and say some words. And there was about 3,500 young people there. And he said, and I warned my youth group what was going to happen. And he said, oh, we've got Holy Family Dufton here today. Can you, you know, stand up for us? And so we all stood up. And then he said, you know, now I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, acknowledge what's happened to your parish. He said, and I'm sorry, you know, on behalf of the church, I'm sorry for the history and for the negligence and for the abuse that happened and so on. And that was an amazing moment. There was it started me on the path to feeling acknowledged, whereas before I felt like Holy Family wasn't being acknowledged. It was in a way, it was too hot to touch. And I can see why our previous Archbishop didn't, you know, kind of kept Holy Family at arm's length, because the media were watching everything that everyone was doing. And so, you know, it'd be, you know, the next day it'd be in the headlines, Archbishop visits, you know, parish with secret, you know, problems or whatever, you know, something, some kind of headline. So that was a good turnaround for us. And basically it started the process of healing that I needed. And when I told Caroline about it, she was really thrilled to hear about it too. And so there's just one more incident I want to talk about before getting to Archbishop Common Soli. I'm taking the long way to get there. But you'll remember we had a journalist from The Age maybe 3 years ago. I don't remember. But anyway, again, you can Google it. It's all there. And she came, my understanding, she came unexpectedly or unannounced before the 9:30 Mass. And she spoke to our previous parish priest, Father Michael. And our current parish priest also called Father Michael, so I'll clarify, Father Michael Shadbot, I should say. And she came and spoke to him and said, can we have an interview? And he told me, he said, oh, are you going to present me, you know, in a particular way, or present the parish in a negative light? And I think she kind of made promises that she'd be fair and whatever else. So she interviewed him, and then they went to the 9:30 Mass and she took notes on his homily, and that was all reported. And then after the 9:30 Mass, she went around speaking to parishioners and asking them questions about the past and so on. So when I arrived, one of our friends, or it might have even been your wife, Priscilla, or one of our mutual friends, I forgot, but it was someone we knew anyway, said, oh, there's a journalist, you know, running around asking questions. And I said to Isabel, let's sort of take the long way around so we don't have to talk to this journalist. Because I really wasn't keen on speaking to anyone about it, considering the things I just mentioned before. So went into Mass. Mass started, everyone stood up. There's Father Michael coming down the procession, and then he stops halfway through the procession when he sees me. He goes, Lindsay, come over here. Excuse me. So I walked up. I said, oh, yes, Father. He goes, there's a journalist out there. I want you to go out and talk to her. So I'm like, okay, yes, Father. So I didn't quite get away with it like I hoped I would have. I turned to Isabel and said, look, sorry, I need to go talk to this journalist. So basically what happened was I walked out of the church and she was actually with her photographer and they were just about to get into their car and I felt really awkward. I said, oh hello, sorry, you know, are you the journalist? And she goes, yeah. And I said, oh, look, my parish priest said it's probably better if I also say a few words to you. So I'm not sure if the way I said it accidentally gave her the impression that she had a scoop coming or something like that, but she straight away got out of her car and said to the photographer, oh, let's go find somewhere to interview him, you know. And so they ended up, we walked from the car park, the big car park on this near the school, through the tennis court area, right round to the other side of the church near where the road was. So it was a really awkward walk. I was trying to sort of like get into a bit of small talk as well, just to reduce the awkwardness. I remember another parishioner watching us, like really, really worried about what was going on. I think she was worried that the journalist had actually accosted me and was taking me somewhere when it was the other way around. Anyway, so we talked for a while, and I just mentioned, you know, I just answered her questions honestly. I didn't try and defend anything. I just talked about, and the main message I gave her was that Holy Family Parish is not that dark place of the 80s where these priests were being sent to anymore. I said, we're a very different place now. And I said something along the lines of, there's a new generation here who are trying to make this place better, you know, who are contributing to this place. And we left it at that. And luckily, I felt like I was presented fairly, which was good. You can find the article online. Just type Lindsay Sant, Holy Family. I'm sure it will come up. And then there was, you know, awkward photo of me, standing in front of the church, you know, as they need to do. So that was another interesting turning point. And fortunately, I think the journalist did a good job. I think she actually presented what she had seen quite fairly. And then that takes us to last weekend, August the 4th. I'd known for a couple of weeks that Archbishop Commensoli was coming.
Yes, our parish priest gave us a heads up. He said, please don't come late.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. He kind of warned us and he goes, you know, everyone come to this mass at 11 o'clock. Yeah, come on time. Yeah, that kind of stuff. And even at the parish council meeting, the current Father Michael Paiopilli, who's our current parish priest, mentioned that this was a pastoral visit. It was a visit that the Archbishop himself wanted to make. And for me, hearing all this these were the right noises. This is what I wanted to hear. This is what I've been actually kind of waiting for to happen and didn't think was going to happen, that a bishop or an archbishop would actually acknowledge. Because we've had bishops come for confirmations and things every year, but haven't acknowledged, you know, encouraged everyone, but hasn't acknowledged the past of our parish. So he came along. Said mass beautifully. You know, he was really actually very inviting, came across as very warm. And I don't say that as he was putting it on. I think he's genuinely quite warm. I've seen him, I actually met him once before at a Catholic youth festival for about 30 seconds, had a quick chat. He wouldn't remember that. I've seen videos of him talking. I've read homilies. I watched his first homily mass online when he was installed as Archbishop of Melbourne 1 year ago. Congratulations, Archbishop, by the way, for 1 year as Archbishop of Melbourne so far, that first anniversary. And it was the apology he gave at the end of Mass, I think, was everything that we needed to hear. And what was more beautiful about it was that they took the initiative to invite people who were victims of abuse or survivors of abuse to be there, or who had been secondary victims because they had been shut out by the church. Or I won't go into the names of these people because they're real people who are alive today, the ones that we know through the media. He had them there, and I actually saw some of them there and some who'd hung around. So I think it was great for them to have that acknowledgement, to have that apology, to have that affirmation, but also the invitation that whatever has happened by these people in the church, this isn't the church. The church is Jesus. You know, the church is Christ, and Christ loves you. And there's a whole lot of healing, and you know, to invite them into the community and to be with us. So I thought he did all the right things and said all the right things in terms of his like discussion. Two more quick things I want to mention. One was that when he said this mass, Father Michael Shadbolt was invited by our current parish priest. Yeah, and this was excellent because he was the priest who copped it, basically. Like, he copped, he had phone calls from the media all the time who wanted to meet with him. You know, he had the archdiocese saying, watch out, this article is going to come out about the parish. You know, he had to go through all the bad stuff that happened as a result. And this was a good priest. You know, this was
He came almost straight after. So I think there was, like you said, there was a priest in the 80s and the early 90s who were the dumping ground ones. Then there was a priest who, I think he lasted 18 months. Then he moved, emigrated to India to go to a hospital.
Yes, yeah.
And then Father Michael, who was there 18 odd years or so.
Yeah.
So he was practically he was straight after these guys. And he bore the brunt when everything hit the fan.
Yes.
He was the one that was the current priest.
Yeah. And I remember a parish council meeting where he was hurting too. He wasn't sure he kind of expressed that he wasn't sure if the church had his back at the time. Now he's moved past that and he's all good now, but I think it was in the moment of hurt, he felt a bit abandoned, you know, for a short while. It wasn't a sustained thing. So
it's probably similar to what you were sort of saying.
Yeah.
You know, pre 2013, there was, you know, Little being officially acknowledged. Like there was slow movements. I don't know if they were similar to us in that they couldn't believe that such a thing, you know, because let's be clear, the previous hierarchy before Archbishop Comasoli, I don't think they were responsible for any of the dumping ground
priests. Correct.
So they knew as much as we did in terms of who would put them there or anything like that. And maybe there was a bit of a slowness to act because a lot of what us at Doveton went through was that, you know, that this can't be possible. It's just, it can't possibly be real that this has happened to that extent. And maybe there was a slowness to move because of that hesitancy to even accept that such a thing could be possible.
Yeah, that I think that's reasonable too. So the second thing I wanted to mention was that straight after Mass, Archbishop Comasoli came to, we had our big hall and we just had tea and coffee there. And he made a point, and there must have been over 100 people who were there. And he made a point to see as many of them as he possibly could. And I think he got through most of the room. What was great, and he's got form on this, right? He saw, and I'll name her Beth McDonald. She's probably the oldest in age and the longest, what do we call it? The longest member of our parish. She was right there from the beginning. There you go. She was there, you know, in her wheelchair, and she's been a stalwart of our parish since its beginning. And she, you know, for example, she's taught catechism. She ran the Legion of Mary for a long time. She ran the Legion of Mary for kids, which I went to for, you know, when I was in primary school. She's just been there and everywhere. And she's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful woman that we all love and respect. And he saw her, she was off near a wall in her wheelchair, and he made a beeline through all the people to go and see her first. And I thought that was beautiful.
Yes, I agree. I was there because I was actually the one who helped set her up there.
Yep.
Because we wanted a spot that was, you know, she was able to see. She also, you know, somewhere she could also sit with the table. So they're trying to squeeze her in between the table and the wall. I was like, let's just move the table.
Yeah.
I'd sort of set her up there. So then I saw him come in, and you're right, he did walk straight to where she was sitting and speak with her.
Yeah. And I've seen him do this before because I watched. People are going to think I'm a Archbishop stalker or something, but I just like to try and keep up with church news. But he did a press club Melbourne presentation. So, you know, the press club is where, you know, politicians and other prominent speakers, you know, speak about something and then get asked questions, you know, by the press. So he did a press club very early in his appointment to Melbourne for the ABC, and journalists were asking questions. And then there was one woman who I think her daughter had been a victim of abuse, and so her lawyer spoke on her behalf. And so once all the question and answering had finished, he straight away got off from the podium and went straight to them and had a chat. Or it might have been straight after a question, actually. No, I think it was straight after the question. So before the questions continue, he went straight to her and spoke to her for a little bit. So a beautiful, beautiful gesture from a bishop, and not a hollow gesture either. It says a lot. I think there's a lot of Pope Francis influence on him. He mentions Pope Francis a lot too, and I think it's timely that he's the person who is saying the things that need to be said and doing the things that need to be done as well. So I feel like we can start to feel like there's some genuine healing going on in our Archdiocese of Melbourne. So that's what I wanted to say about Archbishop Comasoli's visit. Grateful that it happened, and looking forward to other things that he does in this space as well. Did you want to add anything else to that, Jared?
Yeah, a couple of things that he said when he was there as well. So as the Archbishop of Melbourne, he mentioned he had, I think it was over 200 parishes. So he did, like he pointed out, even though it had been a year until he actually came to visit, he said that's actually quite early on because he's got so many. He said if he visited everyone once a week, it would take him over 4 years to get through. So, like you said, he did. Yes, it might have taken a year, but that's still early on for an outlying suburban, because we're on the fringes, I think, just about.
Yeah,
I think the next parish out is in the Diocese of Sale.
There's a parish between us and the Diocese of Sale, but, yeah, we're second last, basically, yeah.
So it's not local for him to travel, so, you know, to make a, he has made a beeline to us to do such things. And yeah, so I joined our parish, Holy Family Parish, about 18, 19 years ago, which is, you know, fortunately before, sorry, after all this, you know, the sexual abuse took place. So we were never exposed to it.
Yeah.
Only heard about it. You know, it was like people that we didn't know, but knew of. So fortunately we didn't see that. I didn't actually go and speak to the Archbishop afterwards. I thought, you know, like you said, there were victims there. There were people who had been affected by it. I think they needed to see the Archbishop more than I did.
Yeah, sure.
I kind of figure if I really want to see the Archbishop, you know, he's on Twitter.
He's on Twitter, yeah. He responds on Twitter too, yeah.
He's a real person. Well, you can get to that in a minute, yeah. But he's a real person. I can go to, you know, Melbourne to see him if I really want to. I think the people that were there and in attendance at church that day, they needed more from him than I did. So I got less to say about him because of that, but I was there, I suppose, as an observer. You know, I can team up with you. We can become Archbishop stalkers together.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, find out more. Yeah, and just on the Twitter thing you were talking about. So I did drop that
last episode too, didn't I? I made a little comment about, you know, possibly getting him involved some way.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we're hoping that could happen. But basically, a couple of hours after he visited, I just tweeted to him and said, thank you, Archbishop Comensoli, for his visit to Holy Family Parish, Dufton. And I wrote, thank you for daring to address the history of our parish with an apology and for your commitment to the people of the church community in Melbourne. And then he tweeted back, which was, I was like, well, shock. Okay, well, he's actually saw what I wrote. He said, thanks, Lindsay. It was great to be among the good folk of Holy Family, Dufton. Good to meet you and your family. Keep up the mission in our schools. I spoke to him about being a teacher and things like that. And then he wrote to me a little bit later and he said that he listened to an episode of our podcast and liked it. And and so we're hoping maybe we can catch up with him at some stage and, I don't know, maybe we'll get him on or see how it goes. It might take a while though, because obviously an Archbishop.
200
parishes and so on. Yeah. So we'll certainly try and keep in touch with him and see how he's going with that.
I suppose the fact that he's aware of our existence as podcasters is further than we had expected or planned to be.
A lot more than, yeah, just a lot more than
a couple of weeks after.
Exactly.
Or like he's, you know, the day after.
Yes. Yeah. So positive things all around. All right. So why don't we wrap it up, because we have another big topic to talk about. All right, so we're going to move on now to Faith Beyond Borders.
Well, I'm actually feeling rather good about this. I think we've all arrived at a very special place, eh? Spiritually, ecumenically.
How do you make somebody love you without affecting free will?
Welcome to my world, son. You come up with an answer to that one, you let me know.
Yes, I had to work very hard to pass Latin and theology.
Oh, quite. Those are, of course, the most important things.
Oh, yeah.
I'd sit this one out, Cap.
I don't see how I can.
These guys come from legend. They're basically gods.
There's only one God, man. And I'm pretty sure he doesn't dress like that.
So, on August the 8th in Australia, it's a wonderful day for the Catholic Church. It's the day that we celebrate, or the feast day of Saint Mary of the Cross MacKillop, who is Australia's first and only at this stage saint.
At this stage,
yeah. There's others in the wings, but she is a woman who is worthy of celebration and is one that I think a lot of Catholics do get excited about talking about. Her presence and her story is well known to a lot of Australian Catholics. People would know something about her just from the mention of her name. So we thought in celebration of her feast day that we would tell some of the story. So we're going to do a bit of on the network, there's a podcast called American Catholic History, where they go through some great stories about Catholic history in the United States, some great anecdotes. Usually goes for 10 minutes. I'm not sure if we're going to keep to the 10-minute mark. But Jerry, you're going to tell us a bit about Mary MacKillop. So why don't you tell us a bit about her story?
All right. Well, she came to Australia not too long after we actually settled. So Australia was, I don't know, 1778 is the big date, and then, you know, subsequently after that, people came across to Australia. So first of all, Mary's parents, Alexandra and Flora, I think it was Flora MacDonald.
Yes.
So they came across. So funnily enough, I think they were both from Scotland, both from the same area of Scotland, and ended up coming separately to Australia, meeting each other and having a family together. So Alexander, who was actually almost all the way to becoming a priest, but left the seminary before his ordination, and then ended up deciding not to go through with it and came to Australia. I think it was in 1838. And then Flora came with her mother and brother in about 1839 or 1840. There's a few conflicting records, you know, going back almost 200 years.
Yeah.
So around then.
There's a margin of error.
So they met each other in 1840, got married in 1840. I thought in those days they were more conservative and took more time to do things, but possibly not. Maybe we take longer to get married in this day and age. And then a couple of years later, firstborn Mary was born, so their firstborn child. They had seven others. Can I go through them anymore? I haven't got them all on screen. So she had seven other siblings. One unfortunately died in childbirth, Alexander, or Alec. And so that was her early life. So Alexander, in a way he was a good father, in other ways he wasn't. So he was a loving father, he was a man of faith, and part of Mary's faith was born of him, you know, being a teacher. So he came from a decent educated background. They couldn't afford education when they came to Australia, but him and Flora were both, you know, they were both clever. They both gave Mary a good education themselves. But what he wasn't good at was making money, even in those day and age. So he went into business, but, you know, things didn't turn out so well. And I think at one stage, they bought a home together and they ended up losing it. And they almost became almost a transient family. There were many places they ended up, living at times, until later on in life, he ended up actually leaving the family and moving to his brother's place, sort of leaving Flora on her own with, I think there was a few, there were still, you know, young kids in the house at that age.
Yes, she raised quite a few children on her own, and I think you'll get to it soon, but it was actually Mary and then one of her brothers who ended up taking the role of supporting the family financially from there.
Yeah, so Mary and her brother John, he was 3 years younger than her, born in 1845. They went out at a young age. So schooling back then obviously wasn't the same as it is now. I think she was working at age 14 as a clerk.
Yep.
And so whatever she was earning was going to the family finances. So, yeah, big Catholic family, but unfortunately they were sort of having to scrape and make do with what they could. So as well as her father imparting his faith onto her, she really credits her mother getting her to be able to trust in the providence of God. So I've got a letter that she wrote to her mother, or an extract from it. She wrote this in 1867, and it says, "Dearest Mama, you ever taught me to look up to and depend on divine providence in every trouble, and when you saw me dull or unhappy, you always had the same sweet reminder for me. So, do not now forget what you were the first to teach me." So she was the first one she learnt off, depending on divine providence. And that comes into play a lot with what she subsequently became.
Correct.
In her adult life. So at age 18, so this is in 1860 now, she left the family home. She moved to Panola in South Australia. So that's about 425 kilometres, 250 miles. And she became governess of her aunt and uncle's children. So this was good for her in that she now had a stable income, a roof over her head, and she was able to send a lot more money back home to her mother. I think she still had, well, she still would have had all of them, all the other kids living at home. While she was still being a governess, she was also caring for and looking out for others in the neighbourhood, in the local area, who were also in deep poverty, you know, didn't have anything at all. She also especially looked after Aboriginals, and she, you know, that was, she was well known for doing that. This is also where she met a priest by the name of Father Julian Woods, and he ended up becoming a spiritual director, and it was to him that she first made a, what would she say? She essentially confided in him to say that when she learnt that her father was, you know, left the priesthood or left the seminary, once she learned that, she had a desire to leave everything that she loved and to serve God alone.
Mm.
And that was sort of forecoming of what she was going to be doing later in life. So did you have anything to add at that stage, Linz, that I might have skipped over?
I think you're doing all right so far, Jerry. Roll on, because I guess the meeting with Father Woods now is a really big turning point in her life, and like you said, about the direction she's about to take. So over to you.
Very good. So at the time, and again, she moved around again. So her main role was doing a lot of teaching. So later on in her 20s, she moved to Portland, not in America, in Western Victoria.
Yep.
This is about 160 kilometres away from Penola, almost close to halfway between home and Penola. She remained in contact with Father Woods, but unfortunately she wasn't able to return until 1866, when she was about 24. So within that time, Father Woods had wanted to start setting up schools in South Australia. There was a real drought of Catholic education there, and Father Woods had wanted to make it. I think he'd also been commissioned by the bishop to look into doing so.
Yeah. So it was. If I could just throw all of this detail, there was Bishop Scheel, who was the bishop at the time, and he was dismayed. In a pastoral letter that he wrote to his priests, basically that there were no government-funded Catholic schools. And he basically said to his priests, Father Tennyson being one of them as well, that if you've got a sizable flock, start educating them, like start giving them the kids of that flock a Catholic education.
Very good. All right. So, yeah, but Mary, she's still providing for her family. I think there are still kids at home, because I think the youngest was 1857, meaning that they would have been born when she was 15, and she's only in her early 20s. So her mum's still got young kids at home, and so Mary still needs to be able to provide for them. So she began teaching in Portland and didn't return until, as I said, 1866, when she was 24 years old. So at Father Wood's request, Father Woods had made approaches to the Josephites in, I think it was France. He had a real pie in the sky shot of trying to get them to come out to South Australia, Penola, and obviously that didn't go ahead. So he wanted to set up his own, and he wanted Mary to be the first one. Obviously she couldn't at that time.
And was this before or after his promotion? Well,
this was all before. So
okay.
Before... So I think the promotion bit's coming.
All right, we'll get to that in a sec. Yep.
So before the promotion, he was trying to set something up, not to the scope that Bishop Scheel was looking at doing, but he wanted to set something up because there was practically nothing, nothing for people. It was all sort of done ad hoc. So he was hoping to get the sisters, I can't remember the name of the place, somewhere in France. Like I said, pie in the sky shot. In those days, over 180 years ago, actually, probably a bit less, more than 150 years ago, trying to get people to come from France to here, even today, why would you want to leave France?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Except possibly
to a backwater colony like Australia.
Well, this would be deep country. Penola is nowhere near Adelaide, which is the capital of South Australia, nowhere near Melbourne. I don't know if it was still Melbourne back then, because this is before Federation, before Victoria as well.
Yeah, would you say very rural?
Very, very rural.
Yeah, even today.
Even today. I mean, there's a highway running through it, sealed roads, fortunately. But, all single lane, very, very rural, very country.
Yeah.
I've lost my spot. okay, so this was a, at Father Wood's request, she wanted to become the first sister of St. Joseph. So on the 19th of March, 1866, this was also the feast day of St. Joseph. She basically signed off on a document saying Sister Mary. So she'd made her choice, obviously made her choice, as I mentioned before, once she heard that her father had turned his back on becoming a priest. But now she's writing that she's going to become a sister. And I've got here that she made her vows on the following year. You've also got 1869, I think, but yes. There seems to be a little bit of...
There's a bit of a difference in the dates there, but...
So I've got a date here saying 15th of August, 1867. Possibly she started her religious vows. Again, like we said, we've gone back 150 years. The information's a little bit difficult to perhaps get it 100% accurate.
Yeah.
So her life path and her vocation, they're finally underway. So what happened later on, because obviously at this stage they just wanted to serve as Penola, just the local area. It was quite a large area, but very barely populated. So I think it was 19. In 1868 was when the new bishop, Lawrence Scheel, became the new bishop of Adelaide. And at his consecration, Father Woods was in attendance. And so, you know, just having a discussion afterwards, you know, congratulations. And they sort of got to talking. And this is where Father Woods talked about, you know, what he was, you know, he had, it was essentially hopes and dreams of what he could do for the, you know, for his region. And following that, and potentially almost straight away, he was installed as the director of Catholic education for all of South Australia. So the whole state, not just his corner of the world.
To get a promotion, the bishop goes, well, guess what? Now you're doing this for all of Adelaide, and so all of South Australia.
Yeah. So Father Woods confided to Mary, you know, getting back to her on this, he said, it passes really my comprehension to understand how, so suddenly and completely, the means for establishing the religious for poor schools are placed in my hands. So something he wanted to do, now he finally had the means to do it.
And more. Yeah.
So at this stage, they moved to Adelaide, both Father Woods and Mary. Mary was also joined at this stage by two of her sisters, Annie and Lexi. And Lexi actually also ended up joining Mary as a sister of St. Joseph.
Yep.
I think Annie only ended up being a teacher and assistant. It's funnily enough, so they've started wearing their habits. They were brown. And this is only in Australia. So they're wearing brown habits. They were sisters of St. Joseph. So guess what they got called?
The Joeys?
Brown Joeys.
Brown Joeys, yes, of course. Yeah, that's a very kangaroo kind of analogy.
Of course, yeah.
Can I just jump in there as well? So having taken this, the final step to becoming religious sisters, Father Woods also wrote a rule for them. So religious orders, people who join, so monks, nuns, so on, if they join an order or priests even, when they join an order, they live by a particular rule, so rules about living, praying, and so on. So the rule of the Josephites was to live poorly, earning nothing in their own right, to depend on divine providence for their subsistence, to go wherever they were needed, and to do all the good they could, and never see an evil without trying to remedy it. And I might just throw in that is actually a very famous phrase of Mary MacKillop that's attributed to her: never see a need without doing something about it. You'll find a lot of schools that are called Mary MacKillop, you know, primary or secondary school, will have that quote somewhere prominently displayed. And it's a very well-known phrase of hers. Jerry.
So the 1860s was, the late 1860s was really a time for growth. So they went to Adelaide, capital of South Australia, and started setting up ministries there. They were also, Mary and a few others went to Brisbane in Queensland. So those states barely touch each other. Long way in between. I didn't actually get the measurements for how far, but it's a long way, in between each one.
And would have been, and especially with the modes of transportation.
Pre-aeroplane days.
Yes, yeah. It's about a long journey. And can I just mention as well, yes, at this stage, the growth of the order. So by this time that you're talking about, they had 82 sisters who were managing 23 schools, an orphanage, a refuge for women, and a house for the homeless.
Do you have a time, a date on that?
This
one?
Was,
or is this when she left?
My understanding is this was just before going to Brisbane. So
cool.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, I've got after Brisbane.
Okay, good. So you can talk about the growth after.
So
that.
After Brisbane, yep, she was up to 130 sisters working at more than 40 schools in both states.
Wow. There you go.
So
yep.
And this is only a couple of years later, I believe. So this is the early 1870s. So while those, I suppose, previous 4 or 5 years was of immense growth and all good things, what happens when you start getting noticed and noticeable is that stuff happens.
The tension starts. Yeah, the problems happen.
So while she was away, problems were arising back home. Some local priests, take it a step further back. So Bishop Scheel had gone across to Ireland looking to recruit. Unfortunately, it was a rather unsuccessful stint because what he brought back wasn't really what you consider priestly material, even for the standards that might have been set back then.
Yeah.
I think he brought back 21, and of that 21, only two actually ended up being and staying as priests in the long run. So for whatever reason, some weren't educated enough, others didn't have the right reasons to come. A myriad of reasons meant that that's a pretty poor strike rate, you know, less than 10%. But anyway, that didn't all happen straight away. So at that time, there were a lot of priests had come back from Ireland, and they had different opinions on what a religious sister should be.
Correct.
So in Ireland, at that point in time, a religious sister came from a good socioeconomic background. They were much more cloistered. They were barely seen. What else do I have about them? There was different internal, the way they ran themselves was different internally, and they were also self-supported.
Yes.
Now compare this to the Sisters of St. Joseph, who were very visible out in the streets helping those who needed it most. There was no sort of central, you know, central governance or anything like that. And there were people who were otherwise homeless, if not for the sisters, were part of their ranks.
And their rule was very different to what was understood. What you just described there is very different to the rules of being a Josephite that I just read out before. So, they were clearly shocked by the way the Josephites were doing religious life compared to what they knew.
So they weren't happy with that. And at that stage, like we said, the Josephites, I don't think it was quite a monopoly on the schooling and teaching system, but they had a huge, huge presence and influence.
Yeah.
So all this gained a focal point with a Father Moran. Now, Father Moran's angle, as best we can ascertain, is that he had a fellow priest, and in some articles I can read, it seems to be his best friend. This guy was alleged, I think this is alleged. Allegations are made regarding sexual misconduct of this guy. They were made by the Sisters of St. Joseph to Father Woods. Remember, he was Mary's spiritual director, and I'm guessing at this stage he was still in charge of the whole operation, or at least in a senior position. And Father Woods went to the Vicar General, who then dismissed this errant priest. And so Father Horan, and there's evidence to suggest that he made it a personal mission and actually vocalized it to destroy Father Woods, and he would do so via attacking the Josephite sisters.
Yeah. Can I jump in and talk about some of the activities?
Because you had a good summary of that.
So essentially, from my own reading from the Josephites website, who have an extensive history about him, one of the ways that he did this was to start spying on the Josephites. So he, I'm not sure if he had a top hat and a mustache and he'd buy a tree or anything, but
a Groucho mask.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So he essentially started spying on them and then started recruiting other priests and other people to also assist him in spying. And gathering, I guess, what they would consider evidence, which ended up in a letter to Bishop Scheele.
Because at this stage, there were factions on either side of this.
Yes. And one of the big pieces of evidence they tried to use was basically, my understanding was that the nuns were not qualified teachers or were not experienced enough to be teachers. So this was one of the big things. But this also led to objections about the rule and leading at one stage to a petition for the bishop to basically take their rule and change it.
There was also allegations made of directed specifically at Mary.
Yes.
Including accusations of being drunk.
Yeah.
Which I don't think they ever ended up being substantiated. And if they were, there were medical reasons behind, you know, the alcohol consumption, because that was a treatment at the time for something she suffered. A long medical word which I struggle to understand.
Well, that's all right. We'll gloss over that.
Okay, so from what I can gather, what happened next is that Bishop Scheele, who essentially his tenure seems to have been blighted by poor leadership since that time, he spent a lot of time in Rome. I think he was in charge for 6 years, and I think he was only in Australia for two of them. obviously, transport and timing of getting to and from places made it a bit difficult, but he didn't spend a lot of time international. Essentially, Father Moran had convinced Bishop Scheele to send Father Woods to Sydney to start a ministry there. And now he's out of the picture.
So he was, from my reading, he was put under Bishop Holding's care. Now, Bishop Holding is a very famous Australian bishop. I think we'll talk about him in a future episode.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically put under his care. And the idea was to keep him there for the quote was, for an unlimited amount of time. So, to stay there forever.
So Father Horan then pressured the bishop to start making changes to the rule of life. Now, you can't do much more to attack, you know, you couldn't have done much more to attack the sisters than to go after the rule of life. And Mary returned at around this time, and in September she wrote, Bishop Scheele, he capitulated, he looked like he was going to start, you know, making changes to that rule of life. And Mary wrote a letter to him, essentially saying that, you know, she, if got, because Bishop Scheele had given his seal of approval to it back in 1868, and, you know, she sort of said, if you can rescind that, you can take that away if you want. But she also said that, I don't think I can operate my life without this rule. This rule has been the guiding principle of how I'm living my life, and I don't think I can follow it, and I'll need to discern God's call for me if this is going to be taken away. And 10 days later, she was excommunicated.
Yeah, which is real. It's amazing when you hear, when you talk about Australia's first saint and you say, do you know at one point she was excommunicated from the church, which is quite an amazing, an extreme reaction. But again, you know, when you look at the way that, you know, the dominoes fell, you know, it just became this problem that snowballed and snowballed into, you know, the factions fighting, and this is what the result was.
And the outcome of obviously her being declared a saint sort of puts into perspective the what she was dealing with.
Yes,
to be excommunicated.
Yeah, she certainly certainly qualifies for a saint if suffering is part of it, and it, you know, having all kinds of these issues, she certainly all of her whole life as a sister was marked by opposition that she had, and usually it was opposition from within, you know, from the place you expect it at least, from the church.
Yeah, I mean, the outside was, you know, just stepping away briefly from the topic, outside was actually, you see the take-up, you know, 130 sisters, there was 40 locations, I think I'd said, in a few short years of operation, and this is without aeroplanes and without proper transport, she was able to set and spread all this up. A small section of what I read was that the governor actually wanted to send his child to Mary's school.
Yes.
But his condition was, I want them to have a seat next to your desk. And Mary said no. And I think the governor ended up coming around to thinking, you know, that is actually the right response.
Yes. He was upset at the beginning, but then kind of realized why she did it. And that's probably a good point to throw in, that the Josephite schools would accept any child who was happy to have a Catholic education, Catholic or not, but as long as they're okay with the idea that this was going to be a Catholic education, and of any class. So if a child couldn't afford an education, they wouldn't be rejected, you know, or kept out from having an education in a Josephite school.
Right. So getting back to the excommunication, so this wasn't just Mary that was affected. Also, the sisters were kicked out of their out of where they were operating out of. And so a lot of them, that was their home.
Yep.
Like we said, you know, some of them came from a homeless background, and then joined up to be a sister, and that was their home. So the ones that had homes did return, and others that didn't have homes, well, fortunately, Mary was high profile enough at that stage, and, you know, the sisters were high profile enough that they were, you know, they had to bounce around a few times, but there were non-Catholics who were able to put them up and give them shelter.
And I'll throw in a prominent Jewish person, Emmanuel Solomon, who actually gave them a rent-free accommodation in a city apartment in Adelaide.
Very good. All right. So this all, you know, it probably seemed like a long time for Mary, but it resolved itself, you know, rather quickly after that. So probably a few months later, early in 1872, Bishop Scheel started going downhill. No coincidence there, maybe. and his health started failing him. And in his last days, he actually reversed the excommunication order.
So we theorized on this, and I think your explanation was better than anything I can think of, because we haven't found, and I'm sure there's a historian out there who could do this for us, but trying to find a record of some reason why he lifted the excommunication. So what was your suggestion about why it possibly happened?
Yeah, so there's little to give an indication what, so it's really only what might have happened. All we sort of really came up with was that potentially someone might have got in his ear and said, you know, this is a really bad idea you're sort of pulling here. You know, look at what this person, Mary, look at what this person has done over the last 4 years to our state, barely any Catholic education to being, you know, a very well-educated state, and you're tearing her down based on the words of someone else. It's also possible he realized himself that he was being misled and didn't have, wasn't making the right decisions.
Right.
And it also could have possibly have been that when you're on your deathbed, sometimes the perfect rationale decisions that you made in your prime or in good health suddenly don't seem like such clever things anymore.
Yeah, as you look back over your life, you think, oh, maybe that thing was a mistake. Yeah. Yep. So were you going to mention the investigation at this stage?
That comes next. So yep. after that, obviously with all this, you know, I'll call it nonsense, with all this nonsense going on, even in that day, that day and age, it reached Rome. And so I think it was Pope Pius the, what number? Do I have his number? I thought it was 9th. But that doesn't seem. No, I don't have the Pope's. I don't have his number on hand.
Yep.
No, I'm not going to quickly find it.
That's all right.
Oh, no. Okay. So Pope Pius IX, well, he was there when she went later on.
Yep.
So the Pope basically wanted to set up an apostolic commission. And so I think it was the bishop from Bathurst in New South Wales and the bishop of Hobart in Tasmania were tasked with finding out what happened, what's going on. And essentially their findings came back completely vindicating the Sisters of St. Joseph, including Mary, so saying that they had done nothing wrong. Father Horan and two of his goons, compatriots,
yep.
they were removed immediately.
Yep.
So all was right there. Now, there was a third thing that they came up with, and this is probably, for me, one of the saddest parts of this whole scenario, is that Father Woods was checked out and found not to be a fit person to be the leader of this ministry, and he was stripped of that role immediately.
And something that I think that hurt him all through his life, and we can see that in his later life, that he never reconciles, I think, with the Institute itself, and I think had a difficult relationship with Mary when she tried to see him, even right up to his last days.
Yeah, correct. When you see, because you see, he was a part of this whole expansion and set up. I don't know if it was the right decision. I'm not going to second guess educated men of 150 years ago on the decision they made.
Yes,
but
yeah.
Unfortunately, it did lead to the breakup of this powerful union, I guess, between Mary and Father Woods that for what they had been able to achieve together. And to me, that's quite a sad outcome of what had all happened.
Yeah. And so the last part of the story we were going to tell, I think, was Mary going to Rome.
Yes.
So why don't you give us a bit of a rundown of what happened there?
All right. So obviously the crux of everything here was about the rule of life. So they had received approval from Bishop Scheel, who was later found to be rather, neglecting any other duties. And so it was decided that Mary would go to Rome on her own to see what she could do to get the rule approved and, if needed to be, revised by the current Pope. Now, I've got that. I've got his name. It's definitely Pope Pius IX.
Yep.
I don't know if that was the same Pope a couple of years ago. I didn't. I only wrote down Pope.
Pope.
when talking about the Apostolic Commission.
Sure.
But yeah, Pope Pius IX in charge. And this is in 1875. So she left in 1873, returned in 1875. So within that time, she went to Rome, and then obviously because it wasn't going to happen overnight, she went and did a whole lot of other things. She went and actually visited her homeland, went to England, Italy, Germany. She actually made visits to other education places over there. So it was almost like a extended work trip.
Yeah,
like.
That's a good one.
So she was recalled to Rome, and so they did make revisions to the rule of life, but when a Pope says it carries a lot more weight. He essentially said that they needed a central government, so it's not just each community operating unto themselves sort of thing, and up against the vow of poverty that they took, that the Institute needed to own some property, so they're not completely living off donations and
providence and so on.
Yeah. So she took that she took that back home, and unfortunately, again, this is probably the knockout blow for her relationship with Father Woods, in that he was very disappointed that she had to take that change to the rule of life, because he thought that they set themselves up with a vow of poverty, and now having her own property, that sort of flew in the face again. And that was sort of another step, as well as being separated forcibly by losing his role. This was, again, Mary taking the Institute in a different direction, which he wasn't happy with again.
Yeah. So I think we're going to...
That probably just about wraps it up. It does go further, of course, but... Yep.
I would say that's probably part one of her story. We might tell part two in a future episode, maybe next year, a year from now, because there's a lot more. This kind of sets her up now. She's recognised by Rome and so on, and then there's a lot more that happens when she, with the Australian Church, in different states with different bishops and different sisters and so on. So I thought maybe at this point we'll just mention a couple of things. Now, first of all, I should probably mention that she was canonized a saint on the 17th of October 2010 by Pope Benedict XVI. And I think even before she was canonized, she already had a legacy. She already had a presence in schools, in churches and so on. Excuse me. And I can say that she's had a profound effect on my own life. And I think it was a proud moment, Jared, when you and I, for different reasons, Jared and I, not spiritual reasons, but Jared and I went to the Asian Soccer Cup final in New South Wales. And I forgot what year that was. Do you remember?
It was an odd year.
Yeah.
Might have been 15.
We'll go with
maybe
15.
17.
Yeah.
Wasn't 19.
Yeah, whenever it was. But I'd been to New South Wales a couple of times, and I think you hadn't really been for a walk around the city or anything much, had you?
Only for World Youth Day.
Right, that's right.
So we were there World Youth Day 2008, and I hadn't been back since then.
So I kind of played tour guide a little bit. And one of the things I wanted to take you to was the Tomb of Mary MacKillop, because I'd been there several times maybe just once before that, you know, for different reasons. And I thought that'd be a great place to go visit. So we went there and visited her tomb at the church there, which is near the rocks, I think it is. What was your impression of visiting that place?
Well, first of all, we made a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
So we walked, I think your phone, this is still early days for, getting phones that count.
Step counts, yep.
So I think,
what was our step count, Derek?
I think it just about top 20,000.
Absolutely.
It was a quiet place.
Yeah.
It was a very, there wasn't, somehow, even though it was that close to Sydney, which is the largest city in Australia, it was quite a bit removed from the noise and the hustle and bustle.
Yeah.
The way they'd kept the place, it was a very sacred experience, I felt, coming through the presence of, this is someone who, far and above any other Australian, has been recognised for their works and for their life.
Yeah.
To be able to spend some time at her tomb, wasn't the same as getting to meet a celebrity, but I think it was something like that, in that
I agree.
This is someone who has made such an important role in the foundation of Australia, not concerned with making rules or telling people or controlling things that made things happen, but such a great formation, especially in the Catholic Church, of what we ended up being today and where we ended up being today.
Yeah, absolutely. If you haven't been to this church, I would suggest that you look it up. The church where Mary MacKillop is kept. But basically, when you walk in, you've got the church, and then sort of off to the right hand side of the altar, or left hand side of the altar, depending which way you're looking. Her tomb is right there. So, and you don't, all you need to do is walk in and walk up to it.
There's no maze. There's no,
very easy to find. Yeah.
No admission fee.
Yeah. No admission fee, nothing like that. There's a museum there as well.
Do they have a cafe?
There's a cafe and a museum.
I think
a gift shop as well. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Pope Benedict XVI, you mentioned, 2008, he went to that place. So when you go there, you walk where a Pope walked. And there's a bust of Mary MacKillop that he presented, which is on display there as well. I had a special moment in 2017. So I went to the Australia. I've gone to all the Catholic youth festivals, the previous three. When I took my youth group there in 2017, we did they got all the pilgrims to walk to the Sydney Meyer Music Bowl? I think it is. Yep. Yeah, where the final mass was. So it was kind of a similar walk, like the World Youth Day walk that we did to Randwick Racecourse. It was a similar idea. But all the pilgrims walked through Mary MacKillop's, through the church where she is. And so everyone had a chance to walk through and visit her tomb and pray. At that stage, Isabel was heavily pregnant with our second son, Alexander. I thought that was a great time to pray for her and for my family. So the religious, medals and crosses that I wear, I took them all off and put in her tomb. I took off my wedding ring and put that there as well, and just had a few moments of silent prayer, with Mary MacKillop for my family. And that was I don't have words to describe how beautiful that was, but it was a beautiful spiritual experience. And because she's an Aussie saint, you can really feel her presence. Her presence is known in the church, and she's a really special person. And again, not because she was perfect, but because she trusted in the providence of God. If you read her letters, it's always about trusting in God to do what you need to do. I thought that was a special experience. I'd suggest, if anyone wants to know more about her, read her words. There are a lot of her letters and a lot of things that she said are online. So, just a beautiful spiritual writer. Like I said before as well, a lot of her phrases from her letters have been extracted and put everywhere. Of this life, she said, we are but travelers here. A colleague of mine at work has this phrase that she always repeats from Mary MacKillop. She says it all the time. She says, be calm and full of hope. And I mentioned before, of course, never see a need without doing anything about it. There are so many wonderful things. I might just read a quick extract from her one of her final letters. She wrote this to her sisters. This was sort of near her final days in 1909. And she wrote, "Whatever troubles may be before you, accept them cheerfully, remembering who you are trying to follow. Do not be afraid. Love one another. Bear with one another and let charity guide your life." So just a beautiful person to read and write about. And I might throw one more anecdote in. We talked about Archbishop Comensoli before. His first homily, when he was installed as Archbishop of Melbourne, he talked about Mary MacKillop as well. And he said, you know, Melbourne Archdiocese, we're saint whisperers here, you know, because she was, you know, born in Melbourne. She was actually baptized at St. Francis Church on Lonsdale Street, where the very expensive Catholic bookshop that has all my money is as well. You know, she's there. And he actually shared this beautiful idea. There's a statue of Mary MacKillop sitting on a stone out in the back sort of courtyard of Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. And he said to the people there, when you get a chance, go and sit with her and look out where she's looking as well. And he was talking about basically the future of possibility for the church and the Archdiocese of Melbourne. So he's clearly taken from her inspiration as well. And I think, like I said, I think she's a beautiful saint for Australia. And I'm really glad that she's the first saint, because she's one that I think can resonate with people of all ages and all walks of life in the church. So anything else you wanted to add there, Jerry?
Very good. Well, as you said, she's our first and currently only. I mean, there's a couple of prospects, but I've just gone to Wikipedia's list of Australian saints.
Mm-hmm.
We've had no venerable since she was promoted in 1992. We've had no blessed since she was promoted in 2010.
They're giving her some space, aren't they?
But there's a lot of servants of God. So hopefully one day she'll be joined by some of these worthy, we'll make sure they're once they're worthy.
Yes, yep. People. I know that there's been discussion of Caroline Chisholm, who, again, amazing woman of faith who did some great things. There was talk, and this is probably more on the grapevine than anything official, but Marjorie Liddy was an Indigenous Australian woman, and she actually painted the logo of the Holy Spirit with Indigenous art for World Youth Day. And we were fortunate enough to see her presentation where she talked about it at one of the catechesis sessions. And she's just this beautiful, humble, amazing lady. And it'd be great if she was canonized, because she actually came to our parish when Deacon Anthony became father. When Father Anthony said his first mass as a priest. He was a priest that was a deacon at our parish for a while. She was there, and she sat in one of the pews there. And I know which pew it was. I was thinking, we could say, oh my gosh, a saint sat there. Yeah, because she's just an amazing woman. And she actually, she died only a couple of weeks or months after she'd visited our parish. So we were very fortunate to have her there.
This is Dom Bettinelli, CEO of the StarQuest Production Network, with a special message seeking your support. StarQuest needs your help. Over the past year, we've grown by leaps and bounds. Every month, we produce dozens of shows covering numerous topics and all explore the intersection of faith and pop culture, which is the core of our mission. Some, like Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, are among the most popular shows StarQuest has ever produced in all its 13-year history. And our newest shows, like American Catholic History, are catching fire with new audiences. We're fulfilling our mission of evangelization in a whole new way, but that success is in danger. We must reach the financial break-even point if we're going to continue. Creating, editing, producing, distributing, and promoting a dozen shows have caused our expenses to rise, and we are no longer making ends meet. We're rapidly eating through our reserves, and soon they'll be gone, and we'll have to cut back many of our shows. We might even have to shut down altogether. That's why it's crucial we hear from you right now. If you haven't yet become a supporter, please do so now. If you are a supporter, please prayerfully consider increasing your support at this time. Please visit sqpn.com/give today and click the Become a Patron button to make your monthly pledge. Or to give a one-time gift, click the Donate button. When you become a patron, you'll have access to exclusive benefits and several special thank you gifts for supporting StarQuest at different levels. The need is urgent, so please go to sqpn.com/give today. Thank you from all of us at StarQuest, and God bless you. May we hear from you today?
All right, so should we wrap it up? All right, so we went a bit over time today, but yeah, important story to tell. Thank you very much for listening to episode 15. episode 15 of The Catholics of Oz. Before we go, we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create The Catholics of Oz. So today we'd like to thank Angie T, John H, Mark S, Thomas D, and John B. Through their generous donations at sqpn.com/give, they make it possible for The Catholics of Oz and all of our other shows at StarQuest to continue. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. Also, do you have any feedback? Do you want any other stories about Mary MacKillop or any of your own personal experiences of her or anything else that we've talked about today? You can send us feedback by visiting sqpn.com/oz, where you can find our show notes and links for today's episode. Don't forget to like us at the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. And also we have a Catholics of Oz Facebook page, which is facebook.com/CatholicsofOz. Come and join us there for and hear more about our latest episodes. You can also reach us by email at catholicsofoz@sqpn.com. Jerry, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Lindsay.
No worries. And thank you very much. Once again, I'm Lindsay Stant. Thank you for joining us for episode 15 of The Catholics of Oz on StarQuest.